Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
He thought he did a lot of rough and rowdy things in his days. And I was thinking about it as I was bouncing through the burn going, well, Richie, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Welcome to the Iditapod. It's a podcast about laughing in the face of danger all the way down the Iditarod Trail. We cover the race as well. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we have too much fun here, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Yes, that was Ed Hopkins from Canada's Yukon Territory off the top there. He has a great laugh and a great mustache. We're going to hear more from him later about temperatures warmer than he's used to and animal encounters along the trail with which he is familiar. But first, this race is shaping up. It's Thursday, and Ali Zirkel has been in the lead since pushing past other mushers resting in Takotna and Ophir onto the old mining town checkpoint of Iditarod. It's actually a ghost town. Nobody lives there. Ali says she's never spent her 24-hour layover there, and she wins the Dorothy G. Page Halfway Award and $3,000 in gold nuggets for being the first to Iditarod. I think they offered her a gold iPhone, like the newest one, either that or the $3,000 in gold nuggets. I'm guessing she took the gold nuggets, but we'll find out later. Anyways, Allie's SP kennel team, all 14 dogs, they pulled into the Iditarod checkpoint about 1:40 Thursday morning, starting their 24-hour rest in the lead. That's going to change sometime today, though, I would expect. Zirkel's competition started to come off their 24-hour mandatory rest already. In Takotna, where our trail reporter Zachariah Hughes was at the time, defending champ Your Life Seth Olson pulled out a couple minutes before 8 p.m. Wednesday night with 13 dogs.
You can leave anytime.
All right. Thank you guys for all the help.
Thank you.
And a wave of front pack mushers followed Olson in the hours after. Not far ahead, another group that had pushed on to the Ophir checkpoint, that includes Girdwood's Nicholas Petit, they also began making that 80-mile leg to Iditarod. That run has appeared to be a slog. Zirkel and Martin Boozer spent much of the day pushing to get there. Before declaring their 24s, Zirkel's average moving pace was a little low, as was Boozer's, and that suggests that the trail was challenging and slow. I saw a video of Boozer going through Takotna, and there was light snow falling, and that can lead to a little slower going on the trail. What's more, it's been warm around the three Yukon River communities that mushers will hit after Iditarod. Race judge and past Iditarod runner Karin Hendrickson says that caused some drop bags in Shagaluk to thaw.
So that can affect the meat. And we just let them know in case they want to change up their plans a little bit, or maybe possibly haul some extra meat out of Iditarod, or just trying to adapt, make sure they have the information they need.
The trail between Iditarod and Shagaluk is slow and hilly, meaning any extra supplies that the mushers pack onto their sleds will weigh them down even more. It's not uncommon for drop bags to thaw, but it increases the risk a team could get spoiled meat. Nobody wants that. Mushers who plan to take their mandatory 8-hour rests in Shagaluk, they might push 26 miles upriver to the checkpoint in Anvik to avoid that. Back up the trail, a lot of Iditarod mushers opted to take their 24s in Takotna, known for its pies. That pause for a full 24 hours, it allows some of the stories from the trail to trickle out, whether, as we're going to hear from Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, there's stories about animal encounters, sled malfunctions, or late-night injuries.
Between Ron and Nikolai, Richie Deal got walloped.
I was looking off side of the trail, like a 45 to the trail, and out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a little reflection outside of my eye. I turned my head, right when I turned my head, there's a tree with a reflector on it, and it hit me. I flew off the sled, and next thing I knew, I was on a dead sprint chasing the sled down, and I dove and caught the sled. All of a sudden, I was standing in the middle of the dogs, and they were all staring at me, and there's blood everywhere. I initially thought I knocked out all my front teeth.
Once back on his sled runners, he could tell it was a serious wound, and he cleaned it with toilet paper and wet wipes as he continued on. Nikolai that morning, folks brought him to the clinic for butterfly stitches. But it's not throwing much of a kink in Diehl's race. He can see fine, is taking care of the wound, and plans to continue on as normal at a competitive pace. Not far from his team is Ed Hopkins, technically an Iditarod rookie, but a seasoned veteran of the Yukon Quest.
I underestimated it. Thought I had it figured out, but obviously I didn't do enough homework.
Hopkins says it's the midday heat and timing runs to avoid it. That's the biggest curveball for his team and race strategy.
I mean, I know how to run in really cold weather and things like that, and I've been doing it for a long time, you know, but this is new to me.
The other major hiccup was the state of the Buffalo tunnels. A rough ride over tussocks and frozen soil with barely any snow to soften the bumps. Hopkins didn't see the bison in the area, just mounds of sign that they'd been around. Moose, however, he did see, and so did Jeff King.
You know, I've lived in Alaska 40 years and I still get that close to a moose, and some of them, you just can't help but go, oh my God, it looks like a dinosaur, it's so huge. These both were just enormous. I mean, good Lord, they're huge, like a Clydesdale horse.
King had two separate encounters, but made it out of both unscathed. Not without excitement, though.
He thought we were chasing him, and as we ran, I saw his hackles go up, and he's like, okay, I'm in for a fight. And I actually encouraged the dogs to go fast, because it was clear he thought we were chasing him. And so the moose is thinking, you're chasing me, and I really wanted to outrun him. And it wasn't until we kind of got in front of him, we were winning the sprint.
As King is talking, he's swapping out the runner plastic on his sled. He's mounting wide white strips, about the width of a palm, that will hopefully help him stay floating on top of the new fresh snow during the upcoming sections of trail. A bit like replacing normal cross-country skis with wide backcountry ones. Though the trail was hard and fast for early stretches of the race, heading up into the Alaska Range, it slowed down in the last day on the way into the interior. It's not clear how much of a role the good trail conditions are playing in one novel element of this year's race. As of Wednesday afternoon, only one musher had scratched, Shaney Traska in Nikolai. Bruce Lee works for the Iditarod Insider and is a race veteran, and says he doesn't recall any race with just a single scratch this far into competition.
Which speaks pretty highly to the caliber of dogs people are raising now and the knowledge that previous mushers have passed on to rookies about feeding and equipment. And that's a pretty successful race to get here and not have a scratch.
Competitors this year are also more closely bunched together than in many prior years. But after the front of the pack mushers come off their 24-hour rests, the race starts to speed up. In Takotna, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Well, we've heard from Ed Hopkins a couple times now, and we'll have Ed thrice to answer today's listener question. That comes to us from Ed's homeland, that's Canada, but a little farther south than his and Michelle Phillips' Tagish Lake Kennel is located.
Hi, Iditapod crew. This is Lisa Hale in Vancouver. Like many people, I've been brought into the mushing world by Blair Braverman and her ugly dogs. My question is this. I've heard that moose are really dangerous and can even attack sled dogs. What strategies do mushers use if they run into a moose on the trail? Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the great question, Lisa, and for the shout-out to all the fans of the Ugly Dogs and Blair Braverman listening to the Iditapod. We appreciate you all coming along with us. Posted an interview with Quince Mountain from Squintna, recorded on Wednesday. He is out there on the trail, struggling with a snow machine, but sounds like they got some things sorted out. So this question about animal encounters along the trail, it's something that comes up not just when the mushers are training, but actually during the Iditarod pretty regularly. Last year, there was a story about musher Marcel Fresino sort of chasing a bison off the trail with her axe, or at least wielding an axe to protect herself as needed. And, you know, they see moose out there and other animals. And this is where Ed's going to come back in. Zach asked Ed about this very question.
I mean, out where you guys are in Tagish, do you see moose on the trail ever?
Yeah, moose and lots of caribou.
For a moose or caribou with a team like yours, do you just let them pass and hope the dogs quiet down? You try and get out in front of it and scare it off?
Well, the caribou are different because they kind of just run through the trees and they'll run across the trail in front of you or behind you. And your dogs just kind of look, but they'll keep on going straight. But the moose over in this side of the border, they seem to be a little bit more aggressive. You know, I had a couple of moose that crossed the trail but they would just stop right there. And I would just, okay, what are you going to do? I'm not stopping. Because if I stop, you know, so, and I would just yell and scream, or the dogs would start barking. They'd all start barking like crazy. And I think that's what scared him off. You know, if one or two barked, maybe he would come at him, but they all just bellowed at it, and he just took right off, both of them.
That was on this trail, or that's earlier?
That's on this trail. This was going between, after the burn, going into Nikolai.
Big bull moose or cows, or?
Nah, about like a three-year-old bull, a couple of three-year-old bulls.
You know. You seem unfazed by it?
No, I mean, I have bigger bulls that run around my place that, I mean, I got some air horns and other kinds of gadgets in here I could have used if I wanted, but...
But I guess Ed didn't need that air horn, thankfully. It's always an interesting thing to hear about the animal encounters. Something I've always been interested in, and something you asked the mushers about as a reporter on this race, is sort of this quirky thing about the dog mushing world. That's when a new litter of puppies is born, oftentimes there will be a theme to the names they're given. For example, Nick Petit has dogs from a litter named after champion Iditarod mushers. Libby, for example, is short for Libby Riddles, the first woman to win the race. This is a topic, the naming of different litters and using different themes, that Zach is really delighted by as well. And in Takatna, he recently found his new favorite examples.
I like litter names because they're usually funny, sometimes kind of self-referential and creative. A friend of mine in Nome had one litter named for cuts of beef, so ribeye, flank, and brisket. Another set of his dogs had weather-themed names like Rainy, Windy, and Flood. It's a lot more elemental. Rookie Blair Braverman, who's a writer, has a set of dogs named after famous authors. So Hunter S. Thompson, Gay Talese, and James Baldwin, those are some of them. Another litter she has is named after characters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a beloved movie and TV series from the 90s. But I have to say, so far, my favorite theme is Matt Fahler's heavy metal litter.
This is Iron Maiden. This is Pink Floyd, Pantera, Led Zeppelin, and Ronnie James Dio. And those are the heavy metal bands. And then my buddy Michael Baker, who's running our two-year-old slash B team, he has the hair metal, the glam rock, David Bowie, Billy Idol.
Twisted Sister.
Twisted Sister. Did you meet them already?
No, I'm just guessing. White Snake. Is White Snake in there?
We had a White Snake. We turned her into a pet dog. She wasn't really enjoying the 1,000-mile perspective. So she's a pet dog in Michigan. And then I can't think of the other name. Oh, Van Halen, Motley Crue, and Bon Jovi. Yeah.
Poetic.
Gotta love the 80s.
The hair metal theme's cute, kind of kitschy. But I think the idea of naming a bunch of sled dogs after heavy metal bands like Pantera is funny, because the style of music, that heavy, sludgy, doomy whole genre, it's like the complete opposite of mushing in the middle of wilderness. But if that's the excuse you need to yell out things like Gee, Iron Maiden, or Haw, Twisted Sister, then I'm all for it.
Slayer! That is the song Raining Blood off of Slayer's album Rain in Blood, released in 1986. Zach's going out on. I'm going out on the same song. It's a cover. Rob Scallon. That's Rob Scallon with the banjo cover of Raining Blood. Our usual theme music is by the band Sassafras. They were off the top, but that's not what's happening today. This is what's happening. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us. We will be back tomorrow with another episode of the Iditapod. Until then, happy trails.
He's taking it well. We're teasing him. His new name is Rocky Deal.